IFL. I wanted to continue the work Sally and I had started, making it her legacy to complete an exercise video for the disabled. I mentioned this idea to Andrew over coffee and a fellow football coach who managed his son's team, just as I did. He seemed comfortable discussing the idea, and I initially assumed he worked in property. Andrew told me that if I was serious, he would help fund the project. However, instead of just producing a single exercise video, he suggested we create a broader library of educational resources. Since we were both deeply invested in our children's futures, we decided to develop a career information video, something that would give young people insight into various job opportunities and inspire them. We named the company IFL, short for Information Film Library, and I joined Andrew at his office on Lassell Street in Greenwich. Ironically, his office was right next door to Charlie's place, a working man's cafe run by Charlie Wright and his wife, Helen. Charlie was a retired professional goalkeeper for Charlton Athletic and later managed York City Football Club. When he retired, he and Helen took over what used to be Lily's, just two doors down from the first deli where Sally and I had worked. Helen and Charlie became good friends. Since their cafe closed early in the afternoon, Helen would often stop by the deli and on several occasions take Ben, who was about 6 months old at the time, for walks around Greenwich Park or along the river. Being back in an office next door to them felt familiar and nostalgic. The space was simple, just two desks, two computers, and stacks of property auction magazines lying around, which reinforced my initial assumption that Andrew's business was in real estate. We began compiling a list of industries to feature in IFL, initially focusing on media, magazine publishing, advertising, television, retail, hairdressing, construction, teaching, and banking. Our first venture was into magazine publishing. We reached out to IPC, and they were incredibly receptive once they understood our goal, to provide young people with insights and inspiration about various career paths. Through IPC, we connected with magazines like Loaded, Shoot, and Woman's Realm, among others. Many employees openly shared their career journeys on camera, discussing their education and the paths they took to break into the industry. We had the opportunity to interview prominent editors, including Sally Cartwright from Hello Magazine. When David Glencourse heard that I had secured a meeting with Sally Cartwright, let alone convinced her to open doors and offer support, he was amazed. As a journalist at the peak of her career, she was incredibly hard to reach, and no one, himself included, had been able to get a meeting with her. It was Sally, once again, who opened another remarkable door. She introduced us to a photographer preparing for a high-profile shoot with none other than Glenda Jackson, Oscar-winning actress turned Member of Parliament, right in the heart of Greenwich Park. The magazine was running a feature on her bold campaign for Mayor of London, and there, in the dappled morning light beneath ancient oaks, we found ourselves witnessing politics, celebrity, and storytelling converge. It was surreal, one of those moments when the improbable felt suddenly ordinary. Our project, now gaining traction, continued to punch well above its weight. We shook hands with Michael Owen at a book signing, filmed sleek fashion models under the chandeliers of the Savoy, and somehow wrangled our way into some of the UK's largest retailers. Tesco invited us to their head office in Cheshunt, rolling out the red carpet as if we were seasoned documentary filmmakers. WH Smith gave us full access to shoot inside one of their flagship stores, while Sky and Sky Sports offered an even bigger platform. Sky in particular saw something in us, something hopeful, something needed. They had just launched their Reach for the Sky initiative, and our mission aligned perfectly. They opened their doors, allowing us to film and interview a wide variety of professionals. Engineers, presenters, producers, each of them shared their journey with candor, offering the kind of real-world insight that couldn't be found in textbooks. Through our ever-widening web of contacts, we were introduced to Flying Pictures, a production company specializing in aerial cinematography. Their footage was jaw-dropping. Camera rigs mounted to helicopters, sweeping over cities and countrysides like a soaring hawk. They, too, shared our passion and contributed insights that brought a whole new level of visual inspiration to our content. We collected quotes, anecdotes, career tips, each one a breadcrumb for young dreamers to follow. Some of the most exciting potential, though, came from right in our own backyard. I introduced Andrew to a spirited young man named Lee Ryan, a local kid I'd watched grow up around Blackheath. His mum ran a hairdressing salon just off the high street. Ryan's and Lee often hung out at our cafe across from the church. He had that indefinable spark, cheeky charm, striking looks, and a hunger to perform. He was constantly auditioning, bouncing between roles, throwing himself into acting and singing gigs with reckless enthusiasm. He had a natural connection with my sons. He'd babysit them, take them to the Heath or Greenwich Park, where they'd kick a ball about or feed the ducks. I saw in him someone who could speak to a generation with authenticity, energy, and a twinkle in his eye. IFL needed a face, a narrator, a presenter to make the interviews sing. Lee was perfect. We even filmed him once, performing the same track he'd used when auditioning for a band called Blue. It was magnetic. He had something. I still regret not keeping that footage. But as our vision grew, our resources shrank. Andrew, already stretched thin, was paying Mark, our cameraman, a weekly wage. That left little room for anyone else. I suspect Andrew might have been enjoying the creative control too, often stepping in to narrate or even sneak into a few scenes, his own private homage to Alfred Hitchcock. Still, the momentum was undeniable. We completed 2 polished videos, magazine publishing and retail, and I hand-burned 20 copies on blank videos, sending them to carefully chosen secondary schools with handwritten letters requesting feedback. Meanwhile, we broke into the advertising world, filming inside the buzzing nerve centers of Britain's most legendary agencies. Bartle Bogle Hegarty, the creative powerhouse behind the Boddington's beer ads and those sultry, unforgettable Haagen-Dazs campaigns. We captured the beating heart of Saatchi & Saatchi and spent long, caffeine-fueled afternoons inside the edgy halls of Lolintas. Every frame we shot felt like a victory. But behind the lens, reality was setting in. The editing process was grueling nights blurred into mornings in a haze of footage, dialogue cuts, and soundtrack tweaking. We still hadn't made a single penny. Yet Andrew pressed on, investing heavily in the belief that this could be something transformative. He purchased a brand new Apple Mac loaded with Adobe Premiere, 2 high-spec Canon XL1S PAL digital camcorders, a Steadicam, sound booms, tripods, the works. It felt like a professional studio crammed into a modest office on Lassell Street. Mark, our cameraman, proved invaluable. He taught me to navigate Adobe Premiere and operate the Mac like a pro. I was learning fast. But enthusiasm doesn't pay the bills, and slowly the pressure closed in. I wasn't drawing a wage. My own finances were dwindling. We had passion. We had momentum. We had vision. But what we needed most was time and money and just a little more luck. The days at IFL soon blurred into weeks, then months. Each morning, the fluorescent buzz of the office lights grew harsher, the silence between phone calls longer, funds were dwindling, and a quiet unease began to settle like dust in the corners. Andrew, usually so composed, started making offhand remarks, mutterings about needing a new source of income, about time running out. It gnawed at me. One gray Thursday, my curiosity finally got the better of me. I asked. Until then, I'd assumed Andrew was in property. It seemed obvious. Our office overflowed with auction house magazines, new issues arriving weekly like clockwork. He drove a brand new Range Rover with a glossy black finish and a top-spec executive Mercedes saloon that looked like it belonged to a hedge fund CEO. Everything about him whispered wealth, steady, established, untouchable. But I was wrong. We'd been working together long enough by now. Hours of shared strategy and silence, enough trust built between us for him to finally lower the mask. What he told me next left me stunned. Andrew wasn't a landlord. He was an architect. A fraud. And this wasn't some petty scam. This was an elaborate, meticulously choreographed financial illusion, one he called with a smirk, his coup. With something between pride and bravado, he explained how he had embezzled hundreds of thousands from British banks, not through brute force, but by constructing an invisible army of identities. It was social engineering at its most dangerous. He began by assembling a cast of accomplices, not criminals in the traditional sense, but people pushed to the brink, desperate souls with broken pasts and nothing left to lose. There was a single mother stripping at night to make rent, a once-respected insurance broker who'd gone bankrupt, a disabled builder who'd been left behind by the system, and even a weary black cab driver drowning in debt. Andrew didn't judge them. He recruited them. He resurrected them. The resurrection process was darkly poetic. He scoured the Guardian obituaries for names, recently deceased individuals whose lives had ended quietly, unnoticed. With a few keystrokes into Experian or Equifax, he uncovered their untouched credit scores. If they had good credit, they were reborn, not in body, but on paper. These ghosts were assigned identities so detailed, so believable, it bordered on genius. Using auction magazines, Andrew sourced empty, unsold homes. These vacant properties became the addresses of his new personas. All mail from these locations was quietly rerouted to a cramped office above a kebab shop in East London, the beating heart of his operation. But it didn't stop there. Each persona had a profession, a client manager, a chef, a sales rep. Each had a workplace, an HR department with a working phone number, and even fictional colleagues ready to vouch for them. To make the identities bulletproof, he relied on a Nigerian contact who was a master forger, supplying passports, utility bills, birth certificates, all crafted to match the made-up lives he'd dreamed up. Then came the execution. One by one, the recruits were trained and dispatched. They'd walk into banks in Cirencester, Cardiff, or wherever their home supposedly was. Armed with perfect paperwork, they'd open accounts. Their fake employers deposited fake wages. Months passed. Credit scores rose. Soon, the banks began to trust them. Then the feeding frenzy began. Each recruit received credit cards, generous limits, no questions asked. They maxed them out, and Andrew let them keep the cash. Next came personal loans, often in the tens of thousands, always under the guise of home improvements. Those funds were funneled into a shell company, a fictitious classic car dealership, with payment references suggesting legitimate vehicle sales. Within 6 months, Andrew's web had pulled in hundreds of thousands. Each recruit operated multiple personas, each with its own financial identity. Dozens of accounts. Dozens of cards. Dozens of loans. The numbers stacked like poker chips in a high-stakes game. And when it was time to disappear, Andrew did it with surgical precision. He told his bank he was closing his business to take a new job. Then he requested the full withdrawal of his earnings. But he was no fool. He knew that withdrawing over £10,000 in cash would trigger alerts to Inland Revenue. So, he arranged a private cash collection through firms like Securicore or G4S, a secure van arriving under the pretense of business operations. No alarms, no suspicions. He got his money, in silence. Each operative took a quarter of what they'd helped steal. The rest, a king's share, went to Andrew. It was all done years ago. And where was the cash? He smiled as he told me, stacked in bricks, hidden in crawl spaces and wardrobes inside his elderly mother's council flat in Elephant and Castle. It was almost laughable. This glittering, precise operation run from a greasy office above a kebab shop, ending in bundles of notes tucked inside a pensioner's home like treasure in a dragon's lair. I listened in stunned silence. He wasn't just stealing money. He was rewriting identities, resurrecting ghosts, and bending the system like it was clay in his hands. And in that moment, watching the pride flicker behind his eyes, I realized Andrew didn't just think he'd pulled off a con. He thought he'd created art.